You're in tune to 2013, the year in review from Brownfield Ag News for America. Hello, I'm Tom Stever. A pleasant story to report in 2013 was the harvest. It's a broad generalization, but most farmers in the 8-state brownfield listening area were surprised, pleasantly so, by their yields on both soybeans and corn, which in the case of corn had a negative effect on the market, but that's later in the program. After a vicious drought in 2012, the most common response that we had from growers is that 2013 was a 180-degree turnaround when comparing each point in the growing season. Many growers faced challenges in planting the crop, and it was common to hear of replanting well into July. What that did was effectively spread the harvest among fields that were ready at widely varying times. I got that impression when I rode a few rounds with Jay Schutte, who farms in mid-Missouri near the city of Mexico. In his combine cab, he told Brownfield that uneven maturity has been a challenge.
We've got beans that still have leaves on them and some that are very ripe just in this area.
Meanwhile, Kevin Hurst at Tarkio in the northwestern corner of Missouri is pleased.
The corn's averaging 170 to 75. The field we just got out of was over 200, and the beans were in the 40s.
In southwestern Iowa, Justin Dahman was cutting soybeans that, for the first time since 1998, were not Roundup ready.
Yeah, we're running conventional soybeans, but tonight a little disappointed in the yields. Beans actually running under 30 bushel here tonight. Our other soybeans have kind of ranged from 41 to 54 for farm averages.
Traveling up Interstate 29 in southeastern South Dakota after one of his worst years last year, John Schaefer is pleased with this year's yields.
This year they're running from lowest was 43 all the way up to 66.
A few miles from Schaefer's place, Eastern South Dakota Farmers Cooperative elevator manager Dave Bobzine is looking at a growing mountain of soybeans, partly due to better than expected yields.
Yeah, we expected probably 45 to 50 bushel beans, but they have surpassed that.
This is Robert Smith from Lenox, South Dakota. I will be 80 years old in August, and in my lifetime, I have never seen a crop like we've had this year, both corn and beans. We have been blessed by the good Lord, and we are very thankful. The beans were excellent, and they were in the 50 bushel range, which is excellent for southeastern South Dakota. And most of the corn is running between 150 to 170 field average. That's excellent.
There was a policy decision from Washington, D.C. that caused unhappiness among supporters of biofuels. That decision is not yet policy, but a proposal to lower the volumes of biofuels that are currently mandated to be blended with petroleum fuels. Brownfield's Megan Grebner reports.
Less than 24 hours after the Environmental Protection Agency dealt what was being called a serious blow to the biofuels industry, EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy visited with Central Indiana farmers. McCarthy said her visit was a chance to have an open and honest discussion with farmers about the importance of biofuels.
We have been working hard to make sure that the level of renewable fuels is increasing as much as it can. And we're hoping that with the proposal that we have an opportunity to look at what are those barriers that are keeping folks from being able to access renewable fuels and get those numbers up.
As farmers shared dialogue with the administrator, they said the scale back is a punch in the gut and said the announcement killed agriculture's golden goose. Even so, McCarthy says the administration knows the value of renewable fuels.
I know how important this is. What I'm trying to let people know is that EPA remains open to new data and new information.
When the floor opened for a little Q&A with the administrator, the Indiana ag community fired back. Mike Nichols farms near Rockport, Indiana. He says the proposal has him, as a farmer, very concerned.
No matter how good a control of our costs we keep, with things like this and dumping of potentially 500 to 700 million bushel corn on this market, no matter my best cost controls, we will be unprofitable.
Jane Aide Stevens is the chief executive officer for Indiana Corn and the Indiana Soybean Alliance. She says they were both surprised and extremely disappointed in EPA's decision. With a projected record corn crop, she wondered how this had happened.
Honestly, I think Big Oil spoke louder than farmers did to the EPA on this. And they beat us on this one. And so we've got 60 days to give farmers and people that believe in renewable fuels to get out and tell the EPA this is wrong.
And that 60-day comment period ends January 28, 2014. I'm Megan Grebner on Brownfield.
And there is the question of impact from that EPA proposal. How will it affect the ethanol industry? How will it affect the demand for corn? And how will it affect corn prices going forward? Brownfield's Ken Anderson says opinions vary.
On one side of the issue, you have those such as American Farm Bureau Federation economist Matt Erickson, who are greatly concerned about a potential 500 million bushel reduction in corn demand in 2014.
Now is not the right time to shed corn demand when farmers have been up to the task of producing a record corn crop.
And Chuck Woodside, the CEO of Minden, Nebraska-based Kappa Ethanol, who says the reduction would definitely have a negative impact not only on the ethanol industry, but on the economy in general.
The estimates are is that it could raise gas prices by 5.7 cents, which I think equates to about a $7.6 billion impact to the economy. In addition to that, we're talking about taking over $2 billion out of the corn market just because of the lowered demand for corn.
But Iowa State University economist David Swenson questioned whether the impact would be as bad as some were predicting.
Rolling it back to last year's levels, that means that maybe at risk within the Iowa economy, literally just a few dozen jobs at the production side. Now, the impacts out into the farm sector, into the grain prices, that's negative. But again, the economists at Iowa State are saying, well, it's not as much as people maybe think it's going to be. Plus, they're anticipating reasonably healthy worldwide demand for exports.
National Farmers Union President Roger Johnson is concerned about the dampening effect that the RFS reduction could have on future investment in biofuels.
We've got some 8 or 9 different projects, real commercial size projects in this country that are under construction or in the very early stages of actual production. Plus, we've got a bunch of biodiesel ones which all fit that advanced biofuel standard. And we're just saying to all those guys that are putting all this money, billions of dollars of at-risk investment capital, close the doors, shut it off, quit investing. And it's just a terrible, terrible decision.
I'm Ken Anderson reporting.
The questions of whether consumers have a right to know where their food comes from and what is in their food continued to generate considerable debate in 2013. Brownfield's Ken Anderson has this report.
Country of origin labeling, COOL for short, and GMO labeling, with GMO standing for genetically modified organisms, continued to make headlines over the past year. In May, the USDA issued a final COOL rule. The American Meat Institute, National Cattle and Beef Association, and National Pork Producers Council continued to challenge COOL in the courts, but in September, a U.S. district judge upheld the revised policy. As the year came to an end, those same groups were lobbying Congress to include modification or repeal of the law in the new farm bill. In mid-November, Nick Giordano of NPPC told Brownfield, unless Congress acts, trade retaliation by Canada and Mexico is likely in 2014.
A very, very good chance the WTO rules against us in spring and summer, then we're in the retaliation phase. And man, there's going to be a lot of U.S. products, companies, and workers, farmers, ranchers, hurt if it comes to that.
But supporters of COOL, including Fred Stokes of the Organization for Competitive Markets, continue to argue that consumers have a right to know where their food comes from.
I mean, if you had a choice between a product from Mexico and one from the U.S., which one would you pick? Or Canada, you know, they've had a BSE problem up there. We believe in an open, transparent, and competitive market, and this is a transparency issue.
The debate over GMOs and whether foods containing GMOs should be labeled as such intensified in 2013. Several state legislatures considered bills requiring GMO labeling, and a few of those passed. Bills to require GMO labeling on the federal level were introduced in Congress, but the effort suffered a setback in November when Washington state voters rejected a GMO labeling initiative. As with COOL, GMO labeling has created a deep divide between different factions in agriculture. This exchange at an Iowa Food Dialogues event in November between Iowa organic farmer Larry Cleverly and Iowa turkey grower Katie Oldhoff summed it up pretty well.
I think strictly from a common sense standpoint that a consumer is entitled to know what's in the food that they're buying.
Will a label tell me whether or not GMOs are safe? I don't think so, but they will probably give the impression that GMOs are dangerous.
Cool and GMO labeling, two issues that are likely to make more headlines in 2014. I'm Ken Anderson.
Meanwhile, three pioneers in GMO technology were lauded this year for their contributions to feeding the world. Here's a report from Brownfield's Julie Harker.
Robert Fraley, Mark Van Montague, and Mary Dell Chilton were formally awarded the World Food Prize in Des Moines. Rob Fraley is an Illinois native who worked on genetic engineering of crops for Monsanto since 1981.
The biotechnology area has been really exciting. It's also had controversy. So, you know, the fact that the World Food Prize chose to recognize, the three individuals who really helped move the biotechnology into crops is really special.
Fraley says supporters and critics of GMO crops should find common ground in the shared challenge of doubling food production in the next 30 years to keep up with the anticipated population boom. Mary Dell Chilton, an Indiana native, works for Monsanto's top competitor, Syngenta. Chilton says more countries are beginning to accept GM crops from the U.S. She credits GMOs for reducing modern ag's impact on the environment.
I really don't understand the opposition to this technology. It's a technology that, for one thing, reduces, and for another thing, in many cases, eliminates the need for some agricultural chemicals.
And the third World Food Prize laureate this year, Mark Van Montague, is the founder and chairman of the Institute of Plant Biotechnology Outreach at Ghent University in Belgium. I'm Julie Harker on Brownfield.
The back-and-forth push and pull continued through 2013 on the resumption of horse processing, also known as horse slaughter. Here's more from Julie Harker.
Federal funding was pulled in 2007 for USDA inspection of horse processing plants. Congress reinstated that funding in 2011. As of this report, horse slaughter was still a no-go. In July, the Humane Society of the United States filed suit against the U.S. Department of Agriculture to block its decision to resume horse slaughter in the U.S. The HSUS claimed horse slaughter plants would pollute local water bodies with blood and offal, permeate the air with foul stenches, and diminish property values. Sue Wallace with the International Equine Business Association, however, said it's ludicrous to call for a full environmental study of three small plants in Iowa, New Mexico, and Missouri, which she says could have implications for the nation's entire meat industry.
Just because they changed the species of large mammal that is being processed inside those four walls, you can imagine what opportunity that would give for HSUS et al. To litigate, and tie up our entire food production system.
Eventually, the USDA granted inspection permits to that Iowa company, the one in New Mexico, and the one in Missouri. In November, the on-again, off-again resumption of horse slaughter in the U.S. was off again. Then comes early December. A federal appeals court lifted that temporary injunction against USDA horse slaughter inspection, ruling that the Humane Society of the United States had failed to meet its burden to keep the injunction in place. David Raines is with Raines Natural Meats in Gallatin, Missouri.
Well, as long as federal courts are concerned, we're good to go. They luckily looked at the science and not the emotion.
But Raines was appealing the state's decision to exclude horse slaughter from a wastewater permit.
So their legal position is not very good at this point. And we're hoping that in a very short time that they will look past the politics and rule with the science and turn our permit loose.
Meanwhile, the attorney for Front Range Equine Rescue said the organization is parallel partners with Humane Society of the United States in trying to stop horse processing in the U.S. Bruce Wagman said both groups are co-plaintiffs in that federal litigation.
I'll play all the cards in the deck. So there's many, many ways in which horse slaughter might get stopped.
They're appealing the recent federal ruling that lifted that injunction on federal inspection of horse slaughter facilities. A few days before Christmas, the Attorney General of the state of New Mexico sued to stop the horse slaughter plant there from going into operation, citing those environmental concerns. I'm Julie Harker.
Activists hold a fair amount of sway in the way that food is produced. Brownfield's Bob Meyer has the story on a group with interests in production agriculture that is holding its ground.
In 2010, Forrest Lucas of the Lucas Oil Company created Protect the Harvest to promote and unify agriculture in resisting such efforts of advocate groups. Brian Klippenstein is executive director.
We need to be attacking this together. An attack on one of us should be viewed as an attack on all of us. And if all of agriculture joins together, and we can win this thing.
As Charlie Arnott likes to say, it's tough to use logic in an emotional argument.
There's a lot of emotion on our side, too. In fact, I think ours is far more compelling. And that's all about affordable food. And it is a critical challenge that agriculture has over the next 40 years, and that is to produce 70% more food. What we've done historically is incredible. What we have to do from this day forward is even more demanding. And if we don't get it done, the price will be paid by the world's most at risk. It's interesting, politically speaking, I have what some might consider a conservative pedigree. But here I am out here with President Jimmy Carter and Bill Gates and Norman Borlaug on their side of the issue with production agriculture, saying we should have compassion for those who rely on affordable food.
Brian Klippenstein, executive director of Protect the Harvest. I'm Bob Meyer, Brownfield.
Coming up in the program, we're going to talk about markets and weather extremes. One of the extremes, the Atlas Blizzard in western South Dakota. An eastern South Dakota feedlot operator had taken in some of the calves left motherless from that storm. I talked to him at the lot where the young animals were now safe and being cared for. David Poppins took delivery of young blizzard survivors at his OK Corral feedlot near Lenox, South Dakota, hundreds of miles from the storm-affected area.
We've got quite a few of the orphan calves here, and he brought in some of the other calves. We had 183 head that we have in the lot here now.
The stress on the calves of losing their mothers is made known by their constant bawling. What the Poppins do now is to slowly get the 500-pound calves on grass, silage, and distiller's grains.
And once they get over missing their mom, too, that takes a few days. So within a week to 10 days, it should be much quieter around here.
David Poppins recently told me the young cattle are thriving in his feedlot and have put on about 150 pounds apiece after the stress of their forced weaning. We'll talk more about that storm and its effects. Plus, we'll get a prognostication on the weather coming up in the next segment. We'll also talk about markets and what moved those markets in the past year. You're in tune to The Year in Review, 2013 on Brownfield, Ag News for America.